Whenever there is a violent event in the news, people often raise questions about the possible connection to mental illness. On today's episode of Intelligence Unclassified, we're joined again by Steve Cremando to help unpack this complex relationship.
This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Welcome back to Intelligence Unclassified, a podcast about counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. Join us as we talk to local and national experts in these fields to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on current trends and issues facing our great state. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed, iTunes, or Google Play. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Unclassified. I'm Dylan. I'm an analyst here at NJOHSP, and I'm joined today by Steve Cremando of the Disaster and Terrorism Branch. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Dylan. How are you?
Good. Please tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'm the Director of Training at the Disaster and Terrorism Branch, which is part of the New Jersey Department of Human Services Division of Mental Health and Addiction Services. This is my 30th year actually working with New Jersey's Disaster and Terrorism Behavioral Health Programs. My background is actually in clinical psychology, but most of my work today is in an area that's often referred to as operational psychology, which can best be described as using psychological concepts for their tactical or their operational value. I was a responder and a supervisor for psychological support services at both the 1993 and 9/11 World Trade Center attacks, the anthrax screening center, and other acts of mass violence. In fact, my first work in terrorism-related cases was in support of the Unabomber case back in the 1990s. I'm a certified threat manager with the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals and a board-certified expert in traumatic stress with the American Academy for Experts in Traumatic Stress. Today, much of my work is focused on helping leaders and operators in law enforcement and intelligence agencies form accurate behavioral assumptions about what individuals and groups are most likely to do in different high-risk situations to help improve community and first responder safety.
So, Steve, you said you were with the training office at your department. What are some of the objectives of the Disaster and Terrorism Branch at the New Jersey Division of Mental Health and Addiction Services?
Well, the branch is focused primarily on the behavioral aspects of disasters, acts of mass violence, and public health emergencies, with special attention to human behavior before, during, and after critical incidents. In addition to providing direct psychological support services to individuals and communities affected by those events, we work closely with partner agencies in county, state, and federal intelligence, law enforcement, and emergency management agencies to help provide insight into behavior of both potential perpetrators and victims of violence. We found that a greater understanding of human behavior can help organizations more effectively prevent, respond to, and recover from violent incidents. In the case of an individual on the possible pathway towards extremist violence, our branch can also help our partners divert someone to the right type of mental health or social service help to potentially prevent an act of violence.
So, of course, after a mass violent incident or a mass casualty event, lots of people have questions. And one of the biggest things is that people want to get those questions answered, whether it's the media or the public. So whenever there is a violent event in the news, people often raise questions about the possible connection of the perpetrator of the incident and a possible connection to having a mental illness. What should listeners of our podcast know about this?
It's really understandable. I mean, it's hard for most people to imagine that a mentally healthy person would deliberately commit an act of mass murder. So it's often assumed that the perpetrator of mass violence must be mentally ill. There's a tendency to overuse mental health problems as an explanation for violence, though. The relationship is far more complex than typically presented. While there is a modest link between mental illness and violence, there is no basis for a generalized fear of people with mental illness. Having a mental illness does not predispose someone to violence of any type, and certainly not to mass violence. In August 2019, the American Psychological Association released a written statement addressing the relationship between gun violence and mental illness. And the crux of this is that blaming mental illness for gun violence is simplistic, inaccurate, and goes against all of the scientific evidence currently available. It's important for all of us to have a fact-based perspective on the relationship between mental illness and mass violence. Mental illnesses are extremely common. Mass violence is not. Despite the fear and public scrutiny, mass shootings are statistically rare events. Mass shootings account for less than 0.2% of homicides in the United States. Even school shootings, the most tragic of such events, are infrequent. The National Institute for Mental Health tells us that today nearly 1 in 5 U.S. adults lives with a mental illness. So great care must be taken to avoid potentially stigmatizing the large number of individuals suffering from some form of mental disorder with absolutely no hint of radicalization or plans to engage in violence. Mental illness plays an important but a limited role in mass violence. In fact, individuals with mental illnesses are more likely to be the victims of violence than the perpetrators. They're more likely to intentionally kill themselves with a gun than to commit a mass shooting or other type of homicide. A subset of these individuals who have committed acts of mass violence have had one or more severe mental illnesses, but most do not. Mental illness may be a contributing factor in some attacks, but it's not a causal factor. Lumping all individuals with mental illness together and assuming that they may be violent would result in millions of harmless, nonviolent individuals recovering from treatable mental health conditions being subjected to discrimination, stigma, rejection, and potentially unwarranted legal restrictions and social controls. Considering mass violence as a mental health problem will not prevent future attacks. It will most likely create additional barriers preventing those who need mental health care from receiving it.
So, Steve, in preventing future acts of mass violence, is there a useful profile of someone who is predisposed to commit mass violence?
It's important to note that there actually is not a useful profile for someone who may commit mass violence, but there are some important commonalities. The Violence Project, funded by the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Institute of Justice, spent 2 years building a database of mass shooters who shot and killed 4 or more people in public places, as well as every shooting incident at schools, workplaces, and houses of worship since 1999. While no clear profile emerged from that study, the data revealed 4 commonalities among perpetrators of nearly all mass shootings. And while these commonalities are not predictors of violence, they can serve as useful indicators of risk. The first commonality is that the vast majority of mass shooters experienced early childhood trauma and exposure to violence at an early age. That trauma may have been parental suicide, physical or sexual abuse, neglect, domestic violence, and/or severe bullying. Such trauma can be a precursor to other mental health concerns, including depression, anxiety, and thought disorders, even suicidality. The second commonality was that practically every mass shooter studied had reached some identifiable crisis point in the weeks or months leading up to the shooting. They often had become angry or despondent because of a specific grievance, whether real or perceived. In many cases, there was leakage or communication to others through noticeable change in behavior, expression of suicidal thoughts, or plans or specific threats of violence. The third is that most of the shooters were obsessed with and studied the actions of other shooters. Many perpetrators studied other attackers and modeled their attacks on previous shootings. Many were inspired or radicalized online in their search for validation or justification for their violent acts. And the fourth commonality is that all of the shooters had the means to carry out their plans. While workplace shooters tended to legally own their weapons, in 80% of school shootings, the perpetrators got their weapons from family members. Shooters in other public places were more likely to acquire their weapons legally.
So you had mentioned that mass shooters will study other shooters, and you also mentioned that some of the perpetrators are radicalized online. Are there certain vulnerabilities of those individuals who are susceptible to being radicalized this way?
Well, there are a few scientific studies focused on the relationship between mental illness and terrorist involvement, and they speak somewhat to those vulnerabilities. There's often a question about whether the presence of a mental health diagnosis is a driver of the radicalization-linked behavior, or whether it's just one ingredient which may add to the individual's vulnerability to radicalization. So both physical and emotional illnesses can lead to isolation. And isolation and loneliness, they can be obstacles to meeting people and forming satisfying and healthy relationships. So radicalization often occurs in individuals who feel disconnected from their communities, are looking for a sense of meaning, looking for a sense of purpose, or seeking a sense of belonging. Some individuals with mental illness may be more susceptible to being motivated or lured down a dangerous path by terrorist narratives. The messages used in terrorist propaganda and by recruiters, it can be very powerful. Many individuals share a mixture of personal life circumstances coupled with an intensification of beliefs that later develop into an idea to engage in violence. Sometimes personal problems can lead to a susceptibility to ideological influences. In other cases, long-held ideological influences become intensified after the experience of personal problems. So it's important to remember that studies of terrorists are often based on really small samples of a very particular terrorist type and not necessarily a depiction of all terrorist populations globally. So it's really difficult to make generalizations from these, you know, relatively small sample sizes.
So when it comes to the study of terrorism, both domestically and internationally, have mental health concerns always been a factor?
So there's a really significant difference between the prevalence of mental illness in lone actor terrorists versus group-based terrorists. And to your question, in early studies of terrorism, the discussion of mental health issues was really not as prevalent. And part of this has to do with what's referred to as the selection effect. Historically, terrorist organizations have shied away from recruiting individuals who may have been mentally ill. The group's leaders often had concerns that someone who might be mentally ill, the risk to operational security. They may be unpredictable. They may have difficulty executing an attack. So that's changed over the last several years as more terrorist attacks are conducted by homegrown violent extremists and lone actor terrorists. In 2016, London's Metropolitan Police Service reported that the Islamic State was, in fact, actively trying to recruit individuals with mental health issues. So today's terrorism threat in the U.S. and in New Jersey is mainly from homegrown violent extremists and lone actors, people who may be inspired by a terrorist group or ideology, but are not necessarily directed by a group or organization. While not all lone actors have a history of mental illness, the odds of a lone actor terrorist having a mental illness is 13.49 times higher than the odds of a group actor having a mental illness. In studies of the relationship between mental illness and terrorism, 40% of lone actor terrorists had a mental disorder. In cases of mass shooting studies, one in about three mass shooters have had untreated severe mental illnesses. So it's important to keep statistics like this in the proper perspective. This is not to say that 40% of individuals with mental illness become terrorists, or that one in three people who are mentally ill commit mass violence. The number of terrorists and mass shooters studied is a relatively small sample, a very narrow and a very select subset of people who are involved in this sort of behavior. So it's not at all indicative of the overall population of individuals who live with a mental illness.
So when it comes to radicalization, what can be done to help reduce the likelihood of someone becoming interested or involved in violence or violent ideologies?
Well, there are actions that may be helpful at the policy level, but those are outside of my scope. But I can tell you about some of the efforts that the disaster and terrorism branches have been involved in that we believe actually can make a big difference. The first is an initiative to provide mental health screeners with accurate and current information about radicalization and mobilization indicators associated with terrorism, as well as targeted violence. Mental health screeners are those mental health workers in local psychiatric emergency departments or hospital crisis intervention units who routinely see individuals who are in some sort of mental health crisis, in which there may be concerns about dangerousness to self, others, or property. There is one screening center in each New Jersey county. There's three actually in Essex due to population density. The screening centers are 24/7, 365 programs that are expert in the assessment of dangerousness, but not always familiar with the indicators of terrorism or mass violence. So screeners work very closely with local police and other community partners to try to connect individuals in need of mental health services with the right type and the right level of care. Mental health screeners are trained and certified by the state. We're working with the certifying organization to provide training on homegrown violent extremists, lone actor terrorists, and targeted violence for every screener as they go through their two-year cycle for recertification. So we're hoping to close the gap by providing more focused information to New Jersey's mental health acute care providers by raising awareness in screeners in recognizing and reporting concerns about potential mass violence or terrorist involvement. We've also been very involved in helping our partners in the law enforcement and intelligence communities learn more about the role of mental illness in mass violence and terrorism, as well as helping them understand the various mental health programs and services in their areas of responsibility. Part of that effort involved working with the Global Peace Foundation, who also conducted similar educational programs for community and family members in recognizing and responding to concerns about radicalization. The model we used first with police officers and then later with corrections, parole, and probation officers was based on the mobilization indicators of homegrown violent extremism developed by the National Counterterrorism Center. The project was very successful, and representatives of our branch worked along with our partners from New Jersey State Police, the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, the New Jersey Attorney General's Office, and members of your team here at the Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. We were invited to present at the National Counterterrorism Center in Tysons Corner, Virginia, where they held a conference last spring highlighting best practices in combating terrorism.
So, Steve, it was really informative to learn about the mental health centers and the mental health screeners throughout the state. What is your office doing with the law enforcement partners in combating this problem?
We've also been working closely with the intelligence community, both here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, but also with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. We've been providing education and support to help analysts and investigators better understand the relationship between mental illness, terrorism, and mass violence, as well as sharing information about resources and services for individuals of concern. In many instances, it may be possible to redirect someone who is radicalizing or moving down a pathway towards violence to healthier and safer options. So we're trying to work both ends of the equation, providing support to the mental health care system to better understand the relationship between mental illness and mass violence, but also providing the same sort of support to the law enforcement and intelligence community so that there's a shared understanding of both the risks and resources to address this problem. By doing so, we hope to reduce the possibility of someone falling through the cracks. Ultimately, we all have the same goal, to keep our community safe. We also have the same objectives, to identify people who may be on a pathway to violence for whatever reason and intervene in an effective way to prevent that violence. And when there's evidence that a mental illness is involved, to quickly connect that individual to the right type of care in the right way that protects their dignity and their rights. So this is a tough challenge, but it only becomes tougher if we're not approaching this problem with accurate information and a reasoned view of the relationship between mental illness and violence. The family and friends of someone struggling with their mental health and thoughts of violence should not be afraid to contact our law enforcement and Homeland Security partners. It's important that we're all working together on the same goal, to solve this problem and to prevent violence.
So, Steve, you talked a lot about what your team over at the Disaster and Terrorism Branch are working on to reduce this violence and radicalization. And then you also mentioned that it's important for family members and friends to remain in contact with law enforcement if they have fears. If a family member or friend does believe that someone they know is in need of mental health care or possibly becoming radicalized or heading down a path of violence, what type of actions can they take?
Dylan, for individuals who are struggling with the powerful or destructive emotions associated with mental illness, help can be found at one of the 23 mental health screening centers across New Jersey or the crisis intervention units that are found in most community hospitals. A list of those screening centers can be found online at New Jersey's Department of Human Services website and is posted on the page for this podcast as well. Concerns that someone may be on a pathway to violence related to this or any other belief system should be reported to the New Jersey Suspicious Activity Reporting System at 1-866-4-SAFE-NJ. If there's an imminent threat of violence or a violent act in progress, call the police at 911.
I want to thank Steve Cremando for joining us on today's podcast and discussing with us what the Disaster and Terrorism Branch is doing to prevent mass violence. So thank you, Steve, for joining us today.
Dylan, it's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
And I want to thank our listeners for participating in today's very informative podcast discussing mental illness and targeted violence. Thank you very much for joining us. And until next time, Intelligence Unclassified, signing out.
All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.